to chapter 2, wrong goals, approaches that will not lead to prosperity. The overall point of this outline and this morning's chapter is to say, if you have any influence in a poor nation, or if you are listening to this recording later and you have a leadership role in a poor nation someplace around the world, here are the mistakes to avoid. And we're going to talk about four of them. Don't focus on these four areas, because if you do, you'll miss the main point, which is making your country more productive. And here, so we look at the map of the world. The green countries are wealthy. Australia, Japan, South Korea, Saudi Arabia, and Oman, because that's oil wealth. Those are unusual exceptions, but very few people have access to it, just the royal family. But then Northern Europe, Scandinavia, England, Canada, the United States, wealthy countries. Then above $20,000 per year per capita income. The United States is $50,000 per year per capita income. But anybody over $20,000 got to be green on the map. Then blue is the middle income countries, $8,000 to $20,000. That's Mexico, much of South America, Russia, China, middle income countries. Red is poor. India is red, for instance, $3,900 per capita income in India, but starting to grow. And then dark red is very poor, which would be Pakistan, Afghanistan, Bangladesh. Haiti would be very poor, and much of sub-Saharan Africa. So that's the situation of the world today. And for those red countries especially, but even the blue countries that are seeking to grow, what can they do? Here are four wrong things. Don't do these four things. Point A on the outline. If you still need an outline, hold up your hand and we'll get you one. Still in the back there, okay. Point A, it's a mistake to depend on donations from other nations. Dependence on foreign aid is harmful. No nation in history has grown wealthy by depending on donations from other nations. And I have a quotation here from Angus Deaton, professor of economics and international affairs at Princeton. He says, the historical record tells us it's possible to grow and eliminate poverty without foreign aid. All of the now rich countries did so. You look at the green countries on the map, they didn't grow through foreign aid in any significant way. And many of the blue countries that have grown as well. Some of the most successful poor countries grew with very little aid relative to their size. And both India and China are growing with very little foreign aid. Aid as we know it, as we have known it, has not helped countries to grow. That's Princeton economic professor Angus Deaton. And Dambisa Moyo of Zambia. So Dambisa Moyo is an economist. She was trained. She grew up in Zambia, in southern Africa, but she was trained at Harvard, did a PhD in economics at Oxford. She worked for the World Bank as a consultant. And she wrote this book 3 years ago called Dead Aid, Why Aid is Not Working and How There is a Better Way for Africa. And she is just blatant in her condemnations of foreign aid. She said it's actually the cause of continuing poverty in Africa. Now wait a minute. We just had an offering last hour to give money to relief aid for the Philippines for the hurricane disaster. Is that wrong? No, she's not talking about emergency relief aid. That meets an urgent need. That's right. Margaret and I put money in that offering. We believe in it. We encourage you to do it too. Yes. And charitable aid that's given through charitable organizations. We help meet urgent needs in many countries. Dambisa Moyo is not talking about that. She's talking about aid that comes from governments, or from the International Monetary Fund or the World Bank, and goes to the governments of foreign countries. Because once the aid money goes not to the local village or the people, but once the aid money goes into the government so it can disperse the foreign aid, then what happens is, oh, give us $5 million and we'll build all these highways. Really? Yes, just give us the $5 million. And what happens? You get the $5 million and you're a leader in the poor country. And first, $2 or $3 million goes in your own pocket, and then You say, well, you know, we already had money set aside for roads, but since the World Bank is giving us money for roads, we'll just take that money and give it to our friends. So money is fungible. It can be put to other uses and shoved and moved around in the budget. And the third thing that can happen is if you're in the government and you are in charge of using the money, you can give it to your friends who don't really build the road. Just you say they're going to build the road, and sorry, we had unexpected, unanticipated construction difficulties and cost overrides. So she said it does again and again. This kind of money given to governments is harmful. It props up corrupt governments, providing them with freely usable cash to maintain their own power. It can discourage a nation from producing its own wealth because the focus is not on increasing productivity, it's on getting gifts from other countries. So why does aid continue? Why do Western governments continue to give aid to poor countries? Well, Dambisa Moyo, she says, about 500,000 people around the world work for these aid agencies, and they want to keep getting paid, and their livelihoods depend on aid. And success in these agencies is measured almost entirely by the amount given, not necessarily the results produced. There are disincentives to evidence gathering and an aversion to recognizing unfavorable results. What are the unfavorable results? Well, economist James Perrone says, the Marxist dictatorship of Ethiopia's Mengistu, Haile Mariam, was a major recipient of donor funds, and it was kept away from the severely affected areas because it suited Mengistu's regime to starve its opponents. So people send aid, he gets the aid, and then he holds it back to get rid of his enemies. President Mobutu of Zaire managed to build a fortune in his Swiss bank account. It was estimated to be $10 billion. The Italian Socialist Party gave heavy financial backing to Somalia's Marxist government of warlord Saeed Barre. The continent itself is rich in resources, but the incentive to produce has been destroyed by government policies. So, foreign aid, but it still continues to be given, even though it's not really assessed. So, Professor Banerjee of MIT, who headed up this forum, a symposium of aid agencies and experts that I mentioned last week called Making Aid Work, he says, the community of aid giving and using has shown no great empathy for evidence. Foreign aid even may make military coups more likely as rebels seek control for financial advantage. And Moyo says many of the civil wars, and she names specific ones in specific countries, many of the civil wars in Africa have been conflicts over control of the government so you can get control of large amounts of the aid money. And then I mentioned two other lifelong development economists, Paul Collier, who used to direct development research at the World Bank, which gave away a lot of this money. He says aid doesn't work, basically, in his book, The Bottom Billion, 2007, Oxford University Press. He's now an Oxford University professor. And William Easterly at New York University, The White Man's Burden, Why the West's Efforts to Aid the Rest Have Done So Much Ill and So Little Good, and also his book, The Elusive Quest for Growth. He's a professor at NYU, but was a researcher at the World Bank for many years. So that's just more references if you want to look at those books. It does not surprise me that foreign aid has not been able to lift poor countries out of poverty, because the biblical teaching in this regard does not encourage us to think that that's going to happen. God's purpose for human beings from the very beginning was to work and create our own goods and services, not to simply receive donations. Adam and Eve, God put them in the garden and told them to fill the earth and subdue the earth and have dominion over it. That meant work. And then he put Adam and Eve in the garden in Genesis 2:15 to work the Garden of Eden and to keep it. When God brought Israel into the Promised Land, he brought them to a land of wheat and barley, vines and fig trees and pomegranates. That means they're going to be farmers. What do farmers do? Starts with a W. Work. Okay. Jean and Mary Kay, did you bring those dates this morning? Did you grow those dates? Oh, okay. They were sure good. But I know that you do a lot of agricultural stuff in your own property, and you have chickens and other things. Goats, I think. Yeah, because we've been there. So, but it's work. Yes. Yes, says Mary Kay. That's work. You can have a lot of wheat and barley and vines and fig trees and pomegranates, but you have to work it. And a land that has iron, its stones are iron, and out of whose hills you can dig copper. But all of a sudden, mining is work and refining is work. The wealth of the nation of Israel would come through work, productive work. And somebody from class, I've forgotten who this was, a couple weeks ago came up after class and said to me this: the manna from heaven that God gave them ceased when they ate from the first harvest in the promised land. And I looked it up, Joshua 5:12. True, you could say that was foreign aid from heaven coming on the people of Israel in the wilderness, but as soon as they got into a land that they could grow their own food, manna stopped. God didn't keep giving them foreign aid from heaven forever. He gave them emergency relief aid in the wilderness, like sending money to the Philippines now. The poor in Israel weren't to live on donations. They had to work. They took the gleanings left in the fields after the first harvesting, Deuteronomy 24:19-22, but they had to go out and get those gleanings and then make them into food. Another provision for poor was to, people were to lend to them without charging interest. I've given Bible verses there, but the poor were expected to repay that loan, which meant work. Or there was indentured servitude, like Jacob serving Laban. And there are other passages, Leviticus 29 and Deuteronomy 15, where people could work for a certain period of time to pay off a debt. But there is no thought in the Bible that poor people or poor nations would become permanent recipients of gifts from money year after year. God didn't promise the people of Israel when they came into the promised land, "We are just going to sit in your hammocks all day long, and people from other nations are going to bring all these goods and services to you." No, it's your work, and I'll bless your work. And the New Testament, Paul rebuked the idle, 1 Thessalonians 5:14, and said, "If anyone is not willing to work, let him not eat," 2 Thessalonians 3:10. Well, this isn't a negative. We should see work as a blessing, a valuable gift from God, because when we work at something and succeed at it, that gives us a sense of joy and satisfaction. And so that's why involuntary unemployment is such a hard thing to bear. Because when people want to work and they can't, it's very, very difficult. But earned success, says Arthur Brooks of the American Enterprise Institute, he said, that's the primary economic factor in making people happy. I've never met Arthur Brooks, but I believe he's a Christian. I think he would say ultimately a relationship with God is what makes people happy. But in economic sense, what gives people satisfaction? Having work to do and then doing it responsibly and carefully. And then having success at it. So depending on donations, if you're a leader in a poor country, I'd say don't just put your focus on trying to get donations and foreign aid from other countries. That's not going to help you. What you need is to focus on producing more in your own nation. How can you do that? Okay, number two, redistribution of wealth from the rich to the poor. I know there was some of this attitude that Barry Asmus and I heard about or felt expressed when we taught in Lima, Peru, about these principles. There was a number of the students at this seminary where we spoke had come from very low economic backgrounds. And there was a sense among many of them that the rich people were just oppressing them. And, well, we need to take the money from the rich and give it to the poor, and then everybody's going to be happy. I want to be careful how we analyze that. I know there are several Christian writers who say God hates inequality and they support reducing inequalities between rich and poor. But I want to separate two categories here. That is, rich people who have done evil or crime in amassing their wealth, that should be corrected. Or rich people who have not done wrong but have been honest and worked hard in amassing their wealth. And then I do not think that money should just be taken from them because they're rich. So that's point one and two here. First, the evil situation. In some nations, yes, people are rich because of an abuse of government power. And if you take the red countries on the map or the blue countries on the map that haven't gained wealth as much as other countries, there is always a small group of wealthy people within every poor country on the earth. Even the dark red countries, there are some wealthy people. And here's how it happens. In communist countries, like North Korea is dark red on the map, but people in high offices in government have privilege and power and resources. In many African nations, people in high government positions help themselves to money from the public treasury. And one of these books, I need to track down the quotation, but in one of these economics books on development, an economic historian said, what you're seeing now in many African countries is the very brightest young students, the smartest ones, the ones who can do really well in school. Then they end up having the ability to go to England to study or to France to study, or they'll go to the United States and study, and they'll get advanced degrees, and they'll come back. Where do they go for careers? They do not become engineers. They do not become doctors. They do not become lawyers. They do not become university professors, and they do not become entrepreneurs and start businesses. Where they go, the very best, brightest, most highly educated students, they all go into government because that's where the money is. Well, something is wrong there in African countries where the high government positions are the most rewarding financially. I can hear about half of you thinking, what about the United States? Isn't this happening in the United States? We're not going to talk about the United States this morning. I'm sorry. You can think what you want, but we're going to talk about poor countries this morning. Okay. In many oil-rich Arab countries, the ruling family and their friends have access to vast amounts of oil wealth. Well, you've seen the stories of the Saudi Arabian royal family, or perhaps others from Oman and other oil-rich countries, where a tiny group of wealthy royal family members have yachts and jet planes and everything else, and everybody else lives in poverty. In some Latin American countries, a few wealthy families have amassed vast amounts of land, money, and power with the help of special privileges and restrictive trade laws made by friendly government officials. And so that's the case in a number of Latin American countries, that progress is hindered because a few families own almost all the land and they have powerful monopolies on businesses. And anybody else who tries to start a business or own some land is frustrated at every point by hundreds of government regulations and inability to get permits or to get legal title to a property or to get a license to run a business. And all of a sudden, the government, the wealthy families, their friends that they have dinner with every night are the judges and the government officials. And they're not going to, they're in collusion together. It's not a genuine free market at all. It's a hindered, crippled, restricted market. And that's point four, a few wealthy families. And sometimes these wealthy families in some countries has come from the drug trade or theft or bribery or extortion. And so now those are evils, all four of those examples. In all of those cases, there are significant structural evils in the way the government functions. The evil has not been punished. In these cases, the crimes need to be punished and the structural evils need to be changed. And the judges somehow need to be reformed so they're not giving favoritism to these rich, powerful people. And the government officials need to somehow be changed so that they don't just give monopoly power to these rich people and their companies. And those laws and enforcement need to be changed so people aren't becoming wealthy off the drug trade and theft and bribery and extortion. Those are evils that need to be addressed. But what I want to say is, those evils, that the people being rich at the top of the pile, the problem is not that they're rich. The problem is they've done wrong. They've committed crimes. They're in collusion with the government. They're abusing government power. There are structural evils. And just even if you took all the money away from those rich people and left the problems, the structural problems in place, the monopolies and the restrictive government power and the unfair courts, you're still not solving the problem because next year they're going to be back in power again with all the wealth. So it isn't rich versus poor, it's evil versus good. It's wrong versus law-abiding citizens. So I want to say that at the beginning. But number two, that's the next page on your outline. In other nations, people are rich because they have legally and rightfully worked and earned more money. The Bible doesn't support the idea, it seems to me, that governments should forcibly take from the rich simply because they are rich and give to the poor beyond basic needs simply because they are poor. Exodus 23:3-6 combines two ideas. You shall not be partial to a poor man in his lawsuit. So if I'm a judge and you come before my court and you're poor, but you've stolen something, I should still say, I'm sorry, you've stolen something, that's wrong. I should convict you. Don't be partial to a poor man. But in verse 6, You shall not pervert the justice due to the poor in his lawsuit. So if you're a poor man and you come before me and the rich guy has stolen from you, but the rich guy is my friend, I can't say, I'm sorry, get out of here, you're poor, you have no power, you're not my friend, I won't uphold the law to protect you. So you don't show partiality to the poor, but you don't neglect to care for the poor, but you should judge righteously and judge fairly according to the law. So you don't favor the poor or don't hinder them. You should do no injustice in court. Leviticus 19:15, you shall not be partial to the poor or defer to the great, but in righteousness you shall judge your neighbor. That was a temptation back in ancient Israel too, for the judge to either be partial to the poor or be partial to the rich. And God says, no, don't do that. Treat everybody alike. The purpose of government is to punish those who do evil and praise those who do good, not punish those who are rich and praise those who are poor. The government should only punish those who do wrong, Romans 13:4, whether rich or poor. To impose a fine on a righteous man is not good, nor to strike the noble for their uprightness. So it seems to me, and you can challenge me in a few minutes if you want to, but it seems to me that the Bible nowhere teaches that it's the responsibility of the government to attempt to equalize incomes between the rich and the poor, or to attempt to reduce all inequality of income between the rich and the poor. The question isn't, do people have unequal incomes? The question is, do people at the low end of the income scale have opportunity? Do the laws protect them? Do they have a legal system that enables them to become more prosperous? And protects their opportunity, perhaps gives them educational, certainly I would think education up to the ability to earn a living, and freedom to start businesses and to compete in new businesses and things like that. That's what's important. So Barry and I got into a discussion of this when we were at the Heritage Foundation about a week and a half ago in Washington, D.C., and they are very concerned as well about increasing emphasis on just reducing inequalities throughout the world. And they said, the problem is not inequalities. The problem is that in some countries, the poor don't have opportunity to become wealthy. And that's the thing that should be addressed. Is there opportunity? And here's the example that I give. And this is when we spoke at this Emmanuel Bible Church in suburban Washington, D.C., this question came up. You say you favor a free market system, but don't inequalities come out of the free market system? And that's an objection we're facing a lot in the culture and society right now. I think we have to say first, well, people have different abilities, they have different skills, they have different talents, whether in sports, whether in music, whether in art, whether in chemistry or biology or medicine, and or in business. And people have different abilities and they have different drive to work and different goals for their lives. And of course, that is going to result in different compensation. We realize that. But shouldn't we try to reduce the gap between the rich and the poor? Now, here's my example. Take a guy who earns $50,000 a year and a guy who earns $500,000 a year. $50,000 and $500,000. Now, let's say the economy has a great year and everybody gets a 10% raise. The guy that's earning $50,000 gets how much more? $5,000 more. He's got a 10% raise. Wow, I'm earning 10% more. This is good. The guy that earns $500,000 a year, he gets a 10% raise. How much more does he get? $50,000 more. So this guy goes up 5, this guy goes up 50. Mathematically, that's always going to happen. 10% growth in a small number is not going to be as big as 10% growth in a big number. Am I making sense? So what's going to happen as an economy grows? The poor are going to get richer, and the rich are going to get richer at a faster rate, and I think it's never going to end. I don't think the only way you can prevent that is move to Cuba. Because they're going to take away all the money from the $500,000 a year guy and make everybody equal in poverty. So that's why University of Chicago economist Milton Friedman said this: a country that puts equality before liberty gets neither. That's Cuba. But a country that puts liberty before equality gets a large measure of both. And then we have material in our book, I'm kind of digressing here for one more minute on this, but we have material in our book showing that the key is whether people at the low income end of the scale have opportunity to advance. And from a 15-16 year period that we tracked, but it can be done for other periods too, in the United States anyway, you take the people in the United States by income, top one-fifth, next one-fifth, then one-fifth, one-fifth, one-fifth. The bottom quintile, the bottom 20% of earners, 15 years later, 93 or 98% of them had moved to a higher income category. Why? Because people at the low end of the income bracket were college students who graduated and then got a job. They were medical school students who were earning nothing, and then all of a sudden they moved to a higher income category. They were people who were starting a business and taking no salary for 2 or 3 years and had no income to speak of. They were living off savings, and then they started earning money from their business. So there's mobility of it, and they're immigrants who earn almost nothing, and then all of a sudden they start a business and they start earning a lot. So there is income mobility in some countries, and the United States still has quite a bit of income mobility over time. So the question is there opportunity at the bottom? But mathematically, you can't prevent the... So what's going to happen throughout history, I think, as nations develop, is the poor are going to get richer and the rich are going to get richer at a faster rate, and mathematically you can't prevent that except by confiscation, by massive confiscation of wealth, and then you destroy incentives to produce. Now, I want to say one more thing at point two. I forgot to put it on the outline, but it is in the book. Point 2E, I do think that governments should provide a safety net for urgent needs. A safety net for urgent needs. So when I say government shouldn't try to equalize income, I'm not saying don't help those in urgent need. I think that where there are people who, even though they've tried or for whatever other reason, they do not have adequate food or clothing or shelter, that the government should provide a safety net for those people so that we don't have people who are really lacking basic necessities. That's not what I'm talking about. I think that is part of doing good for the society, so I would support that. And, of course, many wealthy societies, maybe all, do that. So one wrong idea, if you're a leader of a poor country, don't just try to solve your problem by foreign aid. Second wrong area, don't try to solve your problem just by saying, I've got to take the money from the rich and give it to the poor. But you do need to correct the evils that are being, and the crimes and the wrong that is being done, and the wrongful cronyism among high-powered leaders. And now the third wrong mistake is saying, if we could just find more natural resources and mine more gold or diamonds or discover oil, then we'd solve the problem of poverty in our nation. What happens is that if countries begin to depend on resources, they stop learning how to produce things themselves. And it can become a curse rather than a blessing. So David Landis, the economic historian from Harvard, traces the example of Spain in the 16th and 17th centuries. When the New World was discovered, Spain started sending all these ships over to Mexico, to South America, to the Caribbean, always searching for gold. And they found gold in Mexico, and they found gold in Peru. And they stole it and killed the native population there and took the gold. They were the wealthiest nation in the world in the 16th century. But they stopped training their craftsmen how to make things. They stopped sending business people abroad to learn how to trade with other countries. They stopped learning how to be productive in textiles and other clothing. And they could buy anything they wanted from other countries. So they just became indolent and lazy. And David Landis, this world-renowned economic historian, said the curse of easy riches became a kind of what he calls original sin that persisted in Spain for several hundred years and just put them, after the gold ran out, all of a sudden they're back in poverty and they can't produce their own prosperity anymore. He said the same thing is happening today with oil-rich Muslim nations who are living off oil wealth but aren't building factories and farms and being productive and aren't training people to be skillful craftsmen and skillful producers and manufacturers. So resource wealth can become a resource curse. Now, it is possible, there are some rare exceptions in history, it's possible to use resource wealth wisely. And I've read that Norway, for instance, and since I have Norwegian background, I'm quite happy about this, Norway has used its North Sea oil wealth wisely and not has not deterred it from economic growth and productivity in other areas. And Botswana, under the leadership of Seretse Khama, their first president, who was a hereditary monarch in Botswana, he had become a Christian. His grandfather and father were Christians, and he, when there were abundance of diamonds were discovered underneath some of the tribal land in Botswana, and Seretse Khama learned about it. It was his own tribal land, but before it was known publicly, he passed laws in Botswana saying that the diamond wealth would belong to the whole nation, not to the tribe under whose location it was found. And that meant that the wealth was used much more wisely. And Botswana down here is blue, and it's on the way to just north of South Africa. And it's the hopeful, it's the glimmer of hope, it's the growing productive economy in South Africa, in Southern Africa. It's about $18,000 per year per capita income, and $20,000 gets you into the green category. So Botswana is on the way toward becoming green. But they've used resource wealth wisely, but they're the exception. Resource wealth is dangerous because it can take your eyes off the primary goal, continued creation of more goods and services, and often resources like oil wealth are the basis for civil wars and coups because the people who win the battle get control of the oil wealth or the mineral wealth of a nation, and then they start distributing it to themselves, their own Swiss bank accounts, their families, and their friends. And so a lot of the conflicts in sub-Saharan Africa are conflicts over control of oil or mineral wealth, and resources have become a curse. That's not the right place to focus your hope for growth. Focus it on economic productivity. Point D, the last wrong way to focus your attention, is to say, it's the fault of something outside our country. It's not our fault. We're poor because of something that was done to us, something that happened to us, something that we're beyond the ability to control. So this is the category of blaming poverty on outside factors or entities. Now, before I go to point one, before I go to colonialism, I do want to say something that's in the book that isn't in the outline. There is one case in which it is historically accurate to blame outside influences for your poverty, and that is if you're conquered by a foreign nation. When in the book of Judges, In the book of Judges, when the Midianites oppressed Israel, they would come and they would destroy the crops or steal the crops and take the livestock, and Israel was brought to abject poverty. That happened after World War II here in much of Eastern Europe, with the Soviet Union taking over and forcing communism on much of Eastern Europe so that these Eastern European countries were trapped in poverty, whereas Western Europe was growing economically by leaps and bounds. So military conquest can and often sadly does trap a nation in poverty. So I'm not saying that that doesn't happen. I want to say, yes, that does happen. But apart from that, there is a mistake that comes if you try to just blame poverty on outside factors. Now, colonialism. Is colonialism to blame for the poverty of poor countries? It's a complex question. There were good and bad results that came to different countries as a result of being colonized or ruled by basically some European nation. And the countries that had colonies in other parts of the world were Britain, France, Portugal, Spain, primarily a little bit Germany, and the Netherlands. Those countries went and explored through much of Latin America with Spanish colonies, Africa with French and British and Dutch colonies and some of the Far East in Southern Asia as well, with the Dutch and the French to some degree and the British. What were the results? It's a complex question of history, and there are various academic studies that differ on the question. Some former colonies have prospered, like the one that you live in today. The United States was a colony of Great Britain for a time, till we got our independence in 1776. Canada was a colony, partly of Britain, partly of France. Singapore was a British colony. Where's Roger? Till when did it get independence? 67? But you lived and worked in Singapore for years, didn't you? Oh, in Hong Kong. I'm sorry. I mixed it up. But you know about Singapore anyway. You lived there. Okay. So Singapore was a British colony, but fabulously wealthy today. Hong Kong as well. They're former British colonies. Finland was under control of Russia. Norway was under the control of Sweden, unfortunately. I have a Norwegian grandfather, a Norwegian grandmother, a Swedish grandmother, and an Irish grandfather. So I have a little bit of Swedish in me as well. South Korea and Taiwan were previously colonies of Japan. So they have, in fact, done well economically. They're all in the wealthy countries of the world. Even colonies that suffered harm from colonialism also did experience some gains that we must mention, just from opening the country to commerce with other countries and interaction, and opening the country to trade. And take India, that was a colony of India for India, which was a colony of Britain for 200 years, from about 1757 to 1947, 48. There were mixed results from that, but the country was open to trade. There were roads and railroads built. There were ports developed, buildings. There was water supply in many countries. There was a rule of law and educational system, for instance, which persists today in India. But there is terribly harmful result. There were terribly harmful results from colonialism, too. And P.T. Bauer, the British economist, great expert on the history of economic consequences of colonialism, Bauer says colonial conquest was usually attended by bloodshed, so people died. And then he says that one terribly destructive export from Britain to Africa was socialism. And on pages 87 to 89 of the book, I'm going to read a few sentences. Bauer says that one terribly destructive export that the British brought to Africa was the socialist idea that the government should control the economy of a nation. So governments began to adopt measures for state monopoly of exporting all major crops. So you're going to grow coffee? Well, I'm from the government. I'm here to help you. And I will take your coffee from you and give you a dollar a pound for it, and I'll sell it on the world market at $2 a pound. All of a sudden, the government is keeping all the profits, because you're the only way you can export coffee out of my country is if you do it through this marketing board. And all of a sudden, you're left in poverty getting half of the world price. But you can't do anything else. So that was a harm. Bauer attributes this exportation of socialist ideas to the popularity of socialist theories among British government officials in the 1930s and 1940s. The most influential British civil servants, he says, in charge of African affairs in the 1930s and 1940s shared this belief in socialism, that government should control what is bought and sold and what is produced in an economy and set prices. But state economic control has negative consequences. Bauer says it politicizes life, provokes tension. These controls restrict the movement of people's ideas, commodities, and financial resources. They inhibit productive capital formation. They confer monopolistic profits and benefits on some people and inflict losses on others. The various economic controls were not designed specifically to benefit ordinary Africans, but have always been useful to the politicians and civil servants who impose and administer them. The departing colonialists bequeathed a political and financial bonanza to incoming African politicians. And so, and I quote also, Barry and I quote Acemoglu and Robinson, Recent Economic History, William Easterly in The White Man's Burden, who criticized the results of colonialism in leaving a ruling class in power that was socialist in tendencies and thought it had to control the economy and hindered and stifled economic production. So where colonialism brought socialist theories for government control of the economy, the legacy has been a wealthy and corrupt governing class living above the majority of the population who are oppressed by their own governments and trapped in poverty for generation after generation. Okay. So there was damage. But what I would say, what Barry and I would say to leaders in poor countries is, that's past. The question is, what are you going to do now? The question to do now is, what is going to increase productivity in your country? What can you do to move forward? If you've got a corrupt governing class, somehow heroic leaders have to eject that governing class from power and give opportunities for others to gain governing power and gain business productivity and overcome these destructive results. The question for today is, what can a poor country do now looking forward? Because if you spend all your life as a leader of a poor country saying we're poor because of what was done to us in the past, it's not increasing your productivity. It's not helping. Am I making sense here? The question is, what can we do looking forward in a productive way? And we say in here, if you are a reader of this book and you feel you belong to a country that colonized parts of Africa or South America, and you're feeling that your country did wrong in some of those ways, what can you do if you live in Spain or Portugal or the Netherlands or France or Britain? Well, what we say is, if you want to help now, you can help poor countries in ways that will encourage them to become productive and dismantle the wrongful structural evils that are protecting evil people in power in your country. There are other things that people in wealthy nations can do, and that is agitate politically to reduce the tariffs that keep poor countries from importing into your country, and see if you can influence laws so that corrupt billionaires in a poor country can't put their money in your bank accounts and get away with it. And we say, see if you can invest money in for-profit companies in the poor country. Because if you invest money in a for-profit company in a poor country, say, well, Tanzania, which our church is in. If you invest money in a for-profit company, if that company is working honestly and not breaking the law and is making a profit year after year, well, then all of a sudden, it is providing a useful good that's increasing the GDP of the nation. And Barry and I know some people who have helped to invest, for instance, in a water bottling company in Albania. And a number of areas of Albania do not have good access to healthy, clean water, but this is a for-profit business that will bring benefit to the country, increase its GDP, and bring actually a product that is useful for people. So that's another solution. Okay, colonialism. Number two, blaming agencies that lend money to poor countries. Well, the poor country leader might say, the debt burden we have to pay every year is so great from these loans that we got from the World Bank or the International Monetary Fund. We got these loans, and now we have to service the loans and repay the interest on loans, and it's killing our economy. Please forgive these debts. Wait a minute. If you got a $5 million loan from the World Bank, that is assets that were transferred to you, not taken from you. Nobody took $5 million from you. A $5 million was loaned to you. Your country has those assets now. Now you're saying you can't pay back the interest? The Bible says that borrowers should repay their debts. Psalm 37:21. The wicked borrows but does not pay back. Romans 13:7-8, pay to all what is owed to them. Owe no one anything except to love one another. So the plea for debt forgiveness is basically a plea for more foreign aid in two parts. First you make the loan, then you forgive it. The corrupt leaders who stole the money should repay it, or should be made to repay it, if they stole the money and it wasn't used for productive purposes. Now, Oxford professor Paul Collier says there are cases where he thinks debt forgiveness, rare cases where debt forgiveness might be appropriate, where you've got a wealthy leader that was a tyrant and he stole all the money, put it in a Swiss bank account, and then he fled the country, you can't get him back, or he died, or he's been overthrown, but you've tried to get the money back and you can't get it back, the money's gone. Then new government comes in and it's a responsible government. He said there are cases like that where he could see that debt forgiveness on a limited basis would be appropriate. And perhaps that's right, but in general, it's not the answer, because the debt just represents already money that's been sent to the poor country. Number three, blaming the world economic system and international terms of trade. And you get this kind of objection. You know, these wealthy companies, they just come in and they pay us unfair prices for our coffee or for our bananas or for our tomatoes or whatever. And we can't survive on these unfair prices, but they just all get together and they collude to pay us unfair prices that we can't live on. That's kind of the idea. My response is, no one can control commodity prices on world markets. When I was working on this section of the book, I looked in a Wall Street Journal to find the world market price for coffee. And actually, it's a little harder than that because there are different kinds of coffee and they have different prices. But there was kind of a general basket of coffee, kinds of coffee. And the world market price was 210 cents a pound or $2.10 a pound on the world market for coffee. Now, nobody, no company, no matter how powerful in the world, can depress that price just on their own. So you go to these coffee markets in foreign capitals or in the United States where people are trading and buying, you know, thousands of pounds of coffee. If the price for coffee is 210 cents a pound on the world market, do you think Starbucks can come in the room of all these coffee traders and say, guess what, folks? We're just going to pay $1.50 a pound, 150 cents. They would be laughed out of the room. Say, why should I sell it to you at 150 cents, Starbucks, when I can sell it to all the hundreds of other coffee purchasers in hundreds of countries of the world for $2.10 or 210 cents? Starbucks can't depress the price, nor can any other company depress the price. It's just set by the world interplay of supply and demand. So nobody can control commodity prices on world markets. However, as I mentioned, governments of poor countries can sometimes keep farmers from receiving the world price for crops if you have to sell. What's your name?
John.
If John's a coffee grower and I say, you have to say, the only way you can export coffee from Kenya is if you sell it through this marketing board, you have to sell your coffee. How much am I going to pay you, John? I'm going to pay you $1 a pound. Wait a minute, the world market price is 210 cents a pound. No, I'm sorry, we can only give you $1 a pound. We've got excessive administrative costs, and it's against the law for you to export except through us. Well, then governments can make a monopoly like that, and of course, then they can keep farmers from receiving a fair price. Though many of those marketing boards have been abolished, similar harm comes from companies having monopoly powers. So if I'm the only exporter in the country and nobody else can get a license to be an exporter, you've got to sell to me, then of course I'm not going to pay you a fair price. But the problem there is the government in that poor country. They've got to change the rules. They've got to abolish the monopoly or abolish the marketing board. Point C, here is a problem with something the United States does, but also a number of European countries. Some rich nations dump excess agricultural products on the world market, wrongfully depressing world prices. Farm subsidies, and I talked about this last year in class here when we talked about farm subsidies. The United States sets a subsidy price for wheat. Wheat growers in the United States grow a lot more wheat than the world market would demand, but the government pays them for it, and then we store up all this wheat in huge grain silos. What are we going to do with the wheat? It's going to spoil. Well, we give it away to foreign countries. Uh-oh. What's your name? Mike's a wheat farmer in Argentina. No, I don't know. That's maybe not good. I don't know where you grow wheat. Okay, Argentina. Mike's a wheat farmer in Argentina. He's thinking he's going to get so much for his wheat crop this year, and all of a sudden the United States dumps millions of pounds on the wheat market. Price plummets. You can't get paid enough to live on. So this is a problem. When I speak overseas about this issue, there's a lot of complaint about the United States dumping agricultural products on the world market. And I think the farm subsidies are at fault and should be largely stopped. But poor nations are unlikely to change this on their own. What poor nations can do is shift production to other products that rich nations are not dumping. So Costa Rica did this, growing other kind of specialty products. It's gotten away from products that are not making them money. In addition, rich nations can wrongfully impose harmful tariffs and quotas on products they import from poor nations. Poor nations have little leverage in this, so I think we should abolish those tariffs and quotas that are protecting perhaps certain industries in our countries. But the poor nations can't do this, so they need to focus. They can't change it. So focus on what you can do, and that's producing more. And then, is poverty the result of other nations being rich and big corporations? This is kind of an idea popular in the general culture. We're rich, therefore it's our fault that other people are poor. Do you hear this? And I think there's a misconception here. And that is, these poor nations were poor before other nations became rich. If you go back 250 years, the whole map was dark red. Per capita income was very low throughout the whole world. And some nations began to produce their own prosperity, Northern Europe, North America, lately Japan, South Korea. And they produced more prosperity. But they did this by producing their own goods and services, not by robbing from foreign countries. David Landis says, some countries made an industrial revolution and became rich, others did not and stayed poor. I'm going to skip over point B. You can read that on wages. But point C on the last page, just to conclude with this, the Bible does not blame the rich in general for the poverty of the poor. Sometimes the Bible blames poverty on rulers that oppress others by military power, Proverbs 13:23, and I talked about Israel in Judges 6. Sometimes poverty is blamed on crime, wealthy people who withhold wages wrongfully, James 5:4. And people who have more are expected to help those in need, especially Christians in need, 1 John 3:17. If anyone has this world's goods and sees his brother in need, yet closes his heart against him, how does God's love abide in him? Where we see urgent needs, we should do what we can to meet those needs. But point four, the mere fact that some people are rich is never in itself said to be a cause of poverty for others. Scripture never blames wealthy people or wealthy nations in general for the situations of those in poverty. Conclusion. If you are a leader in a poor country or you have influence on the leaders in poor country, don't set your hope for economic progress on foreign aid. Don't set your hope on resource development. Don't set your hope on debt forgiveness. Don't set your hope on taking from the rich and giving to the poor. Don't set your hope on blaming factors outside your nation. Set your hope on growing your own economy, producing your own goods and services. And that's the 79 factors that we're going to start in a couple of weeks talking about. I have 8 minutes left to interact. Comments, questions? What do you think? Oh, Barry.
How long was Norway under Sweden?
I don't know how long Norway was under Sweden.
Don't they still, for a lot of their, for the most part, still both countries are a little bit socialistic?
They are more socialistic. Their wealth grew and their economic system developed in much more of a free market economy. But since World War II, there's been more of a government control of the economy. So we have $50,000 per capita income. Norway has $55,000 or $56,000 per capita income. But when you compare disposable income, how much people have free to spend, we're ahead of Norway because the government takes a lot from people. Is that going to hinder them from what growth they could have? Yes, I think to some degree, but it hasn't hit yet.
And my final question, it seems like socialism is obviously not a good thing to do, but yet people around the world promote socialism.
Yeah.
Can you give the argument for socialism?
The argument is primarily government has to control the money to care for the needy, to care for the poor, so we can best distribute it. But it is a free market system that truly cares for the poor because it gives people opportunity to become wealthy. So, you know, Beery's going to talk about socialism and communism next week. Pure socialism owns all the factories and all the mines and all the farms. Partial socialism owns some of those. Okay. Lisa.
Thanks. To provide opportunities for poor people, would you support free university and college education?
Huh. That group? Yeah. It's very interesting. I think, Lisa, what happens is in the United States, in earlier years, we thought everybody should be educated up to high school, grade 12, because that's what you needed to earn a living. Okay? Gradually, we are shifting toward making opportunities for college education, or have shifted in the last 30 or 40 years, more available somehow through loans and grants to everybody in society who has the ability to learn. I think wealthy nations have the ability to do that, to make more education available. The problem is that when government pays, the price goes up and up and up and up and up. And we're seeing that happen, sadly. So I'm not sure. It's a political question that I don't feel qualified to decide. You either limit the number of people who can get college education by requiring people to pay, or you limit it by having tests and competitions and see who can best get in. So, what else? Is this whole thing making any sense? Okay, Donna over here.
Most of us have very little power to influence a nation.
Yep.
But I'm wondering what your thought is about charities like Samaritan's Purse and World Vision.
Yep.
Who we get catalogs at Christmas time.
Yes.
And you can donate a goat or you know, some way for people,
yep,
a sewing machine,
yep,
a bicycle,
yep,
you know, that will help people, individual people,
okay,
individual families.
Yes.
Make a living.
Okay. So, Donna, thank you for bringing that up, because I want to say this. Anything we can do to help people in poor nations become more productive, it helps the whole economy grow. So a sewing machine is a way to become productive and earn a living. So that's great. What we're saying is those things can help individuals, and they can meet urgent needs if it's food or clothing. But they don't solve the problem, which is the laws need to be changed and the economic system needs to be changed so that the person who has the sewing machine can actually keep the profit from what she sews. And the cultural values have to be changed so if she gets a little more money, her neighbors don't all think they can steal it from her. So our book is not talking about how to help poor individuals, where there's a lot of good going on, and we don't want to minimize that. We're saying, what about the level of the whole nation? Here's what has to be done. But we can keep on doing the other to help the individuals, okay? Fred Beasley, Fred was here this morning, and he just left. Okay, one of these weeks he's going to talk about how all this works in with the mission work of Scottsdale Bible Church. He and I talked last week, so, yeah.
You know, last week you mentioned Jared Diamond, and he's,
yep,
very popular among the progressives that I work with.
Yeah.
If you were going to encapsulate your how you differ from Jared Diamond, what a pro free market person would say opposed to Jared Diamond, what would that be?
Human choices make a difference. That is, Jared Diamond wrote this book, Guns, Germs, and Steel, won a Pulitzer Prize. He said, rich nations are rich because they had good rivers, good ports, good natural resources, and domesticatable animals. And the poor nations didn't, and they stayed poor. But that's just saying it's fate. That's saying you can't do anything about it. My answer would be say, well, that may explain why that's one of the factors, okay? But I actually live in a very inhospitable climate here in Arizona. But Arizona is a prosperous economy. Why? Because economic development has overcome the hostile economic factors. So Hong Kong, Singapore, prosperous in spite of a very inhospitable climate in some areas. Hong Kong's horribly hot, isn't it? Roger, Hong Kong's very, very hot, isn't it? It's on the equator, yeah, but okay, it's prosperous. So I would say, Jared Diamond, you're not leaving any hope for people. You're saying it's all fate. Your geography determines your destiny. Sorry, no. Human choices make a big difference, and human cultural values and beliefs, we're going to get to that, they can transform whole nations, and that's the hope we want to hold out. So good question. Yeah. Is it Loretta?
Do you see any correlation between the religions of the poorer countries and that of the richer countries?
To some degree. And at one point in our book, we say there's a study by Lawrence Harrison of Tufts University where he took the cultural background, religious background of the cultures of wealthy and poor countries and measured them by income. Highest was Protestant background, Northern Europe, North America. Next highest was Jewish background, of which there's only one country, Israel. The next was Roman Catholic background, which would be Southern Europe. And then on down the line is Buddhist and Hindu and Muslim, or Muslim and Hindu. And he thinks there's a correlation because of the view of the earth, the view of whether your human efforts can change the future, view of productivity, some views of moral standard. If you think you're trapped in a lower caste by fate forever as a Hindu system, you're not going to be as productive. So yes, there is a correlation. But Japan didn't have Christianity. It had a form of Buddhism that made work into a religion. And so by following a number of wise economic principles, it grew anyway, even though it wasn't Christian. So it's not 100%. But generally, there has been a correlation. And that's why it's not accident. We've got 478 quotations of scripture in this book. So we're saying these are biblical values. What else? Somebody else? Okay.
What specifically about the Muslims?
What about Islam that makes it... resistance to knowledge from other sources, resistance to training of women as well as men, education of women as well as men, rights for women as well as men, resistance to openness from other countries and interaction with trade, sense of fatalism, Allah wills. I don't have a job yet. Well, Allah didn't will me to have a job. There's a fatalism rather than an aggressive desire to change. So a number of things. That's just off the top of my head. But they're progress-resistant factors. Okay. This has been not a hopeful day. This has been all the wrong things that can be done. And so I'm only alluding to the hopeful things. But don't get discouraged. There are positive things that can be done. We're going to go through 79 things that cultures can do and nations can do that can change in a hopeful, positive way. But next week is going to be one more kind of informative background week where Barry talks about failed economic systems. He will talk about socialism and communism, and he's very good at talking about those things. But other failed economic systems as well. Lord, we ask for your wisdom in knowing how to think about these issues and guiding us where we have conversations or opportunities to use time or influence or money to bring good to poor nations. We do pray for those poor nations of the world that are seeking to grow economically, that you would, first of all, help them to know you and to grow in relationship with you spiritually and in their relationship with their family and friends as those exist, not to lose those things, but also help them to grow and be wise economically, Lord, and give us wisdom to know how to help them where we can. Amen.